Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to Old Brother, a podcast about Salford / Manchester's legendary and much-missed musical institution, The Fall. Each week we invite along a guest to chat about their experiences and memories of the group. If you're wondering, we consist of me, Paul Hanley, and my brother Steve, who, as you probably know, was a member of The Fall for 20 years. You can find us at all the usual suspects, but we're hosted at play.acast.com/s/oldbrother. In this first episode of Series 2, we're delighted to be speaking to the legendary artist, comedian, actor and quiz show host, Mr. Jim Moyer, better known to the world as Vic Reeves, about what The Fall meant to him. You'll enjoy this, it's a cracker.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Old Brother podcast, a Fall podcast, as Steve likes to say, not the Fall podcast. And we're delighted much honoured with our guest today, who is the celebrated artist and bon viveur, Mr. Jim Moyer. Possibly better known by his nom de voyage of Vic Reeves.
Yes, that's right, yeah. And here I am.
Morning.
Good morning, lads. Morning, gentlemen, old fellas.
Old fellas, yes. Chaps. Yeah. I think we should bring the word chap back. I think that's a nice term for a gentleman of a certain age. Chaps. He was a lovely chap.
Hello, chaps. I know it sounds a bit too posh for me.
Jesus. So you well, Jim?
Yeah, I'm very good. It's a nice, brisk, cold day. Blue skies, and that's the kind of way I like it.
Yeah. So are we keeping you from your painting this morning then? Because you'd like to start about 7, don't you?
I start 6 or 7 in the morning. But no, today is a day off. I'm going to go to the capital with my wife to do some shopping.
Lovely. With the Christmas, early Christmas shopping?
Well, that's what she calls it. I call it, you know, nosing around the shops and, you know. Yeah, I suppose it is Christmas. I don't know. I don't know if I really like a point in Christmas until it's December.
No, quite so. Dead right. Although it seems to start. Right. When did you start with the? When did they start selling Christmas trees this year? Seems to get earlier every year.
So we don't want the entire year to be Christmas, do we?
No.
But at the moment, it's like you get 2 months of Christmas. And that's, it's too much of your life.
Yeah.
I was saying this to my daughter the other day on the way to school. I said, you spend like a third of your day asleep. That's a third of your life, isn't it? So if you get to 90, you've been asleep for 30 years. And you then reduce that down to the amount of time that you're celebrating Christmas.
It's not much left. There was an interview with Michael Bublé on the radio yesterday, and she said about his Christmas album, and he said, yeah, I always thought that was the best holiday to write an album about. So your album of Easter hits isn't coming out so quick then, is it?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, let's start. I'm not religious in any way, but let's do Lent.
Michael Bublé presents his Lent album.
Yeah.
No meat on Wednesday. What a hit that was.
Yeah, that's a good one. Let's do Lent.
Fish on Friday.
Vic Reeves presents Let's Do Rent. Rent? Oh, that was a Freudian slip. Keep the rent, my love.
Yeah, Lent all day.
Right, so the first thing I was going to ask you about, your art show that was on in... started in Manchester a couple of weeks ago. Steve was lucky enough to get there. I had to work. Someone's got to keep the wheels of industry going, I suppose. But why did you pick Manchester? I was going to ask you, why did you pick Manchester?
Because I really like Manchester. I love Manchester. I like the whole viewpoint of Manchester. Yeah. I like the people. I like the look of it. I like the feel of it. It's got a great feel, Manchester. So that's why I did it. I got offered it, and then I went, you know, much more than that. And I like going for a night out in Manchester. It's like, you know, when you do gig. I went and did a gig last night for the first time in years and years. The first time I did a singing gig in about, I don't know, 20 odd years. I went with Jules Holland, and I was with his big band, and I was in Southampton, and 3,500 seater. And it just reminded me, in fact, what was I saying? What I was going to say was the best audiences are in Manchester. I always used to look forward to going to Manchester when we were on tour doing anything.
Yeah.
They're out for a good night out. It's like they've paid the money and they're going to enjoy themselves.
Yes. Well, you're preaching to the choir here. I'm quite appreciative of coming from Manchester, I must admit. I always say that. I'm always glad my mum and dad got the train to Manchester when they got off in Liverpool. You know, they didn't stop where they were.
Because you lot are off from Ireland, aren't you?
We are.
I was watching Back to the Future yesterday. He said,
I've read the books. I know all about you.
That sounds vaguely menacing, that.
Yes. I know.
That sounds worrying.
I know. Your Irish background, your pie shops and everything.
Yeah, blimey.
Yeah, but you should.
That's got to be the next book. That's the next book all about the pie shop.
You should do. That would be a great thing. I think pies are a much maligned... dish.
Oh, you can't beat a pie.
In Australia. Massively popular in Australia. Yes.
They put mash on the top, don't they, in Australia?
And peas, yeah.
Yeah.
On the top, yeah. Well, I'd put it underneath.
Yes. Peas on the bottom, meat in the middle, mash on the top. Really
a good way of making a fish pie, which is a kind of different thing, but if you get mushy peas and put that on the bottom and then put all the fish on the top, and then you mash on top of that. Yeah, that's a good way of doing a fish.
No sauce, no white sauce, no bechamel, if you will.
Well, you can do, but put right at the bottom of mushy peas, Yeah.
Any particular brand of mushy peas your favourite? Campbell's?
This is pretty good. I can see the label. I can't remember what
they're called. Bachelors, is it?
No? Bachelors.
That's it, yes. Bachelors.
Well, I suppose we better talk about the fall at some point, haven't we?
I suppose at some point, yeah.
The question we always ask is, what was your first encounter with the fall then?
Like everyone else, on John Peel. And I moved to London from Darlington in 1979. With me mate Jack, we used to share a bedroom in Brixton. So he'd have a bed at one side and I'd have a bed at the other side. And in the middle was a radio and John Peel was on. So we used to go to bed, put John Peel on and drop off.
To the sound of some Bolivian nose flute.
To the youngest set, that probably sounds a bit wartime, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yes. With your cat's whiskers radio.
Yeah, it was just an old-fashioned radio that was in between us. Well, we'll go to bed, put John Peel on and drop off. And he would play The Mighty Fall, as he used to call you.
I mean, it's become a bit of a cliche, that thing about listening to John Peel under the bed covers. But everybody did it, didn't they?
Well, I think we were the bed covers. I was 20 at the time, so you know, I was.
It was allowed.
it was above the bed
covers. what year is this then?
1979.
Okay, right at the beginning then. Really? Okay.
So that was when you were at art school, was it?
No, I left Darlington and went to Brixton.
Right.
And I went to work in a factory. And I had to get up about 6 o'clock in the morning. So I think, you know, it was. Pale started about 10. So I think I was probably going to bed about 10 and dropping off at half 10. So if you got in the first half hour, you're in the listen.
So what was the first? So that'll have been what? Dragnet kind of time, will it?
It would have been, yeah. And then. I became a really like massive Fall fan almost instantly.
So, surely you waited till March 1980 when they sorted the drummer situation out, surely.
Yeah, I'd have to. Yeah, I've got a prediction of the future. I'm just going to put this on hold.
So when did you first see him live then?
About then, I think. The Fall were on in Norwich in 79, and the support group was the Higsons, which was Charlie Higson. It was at the Norwich
University.
Yeah,
it was one of my first gigs. That
was it. Well, Charlie Higson was. I was staying at Charlie Higson's house because he was a friend. Of a friend of mine from Darlington, and that's how I met Charlie Higson and Paul Whitehouse and Harry Enfield. They were all at Norwich University, and Charlie was having a party at his house, and you all came and didn't hang around long. And
it's a long drive back from Norwich.
It was quite cold, and you all turned up in parkas. And they were all a bit snotty. They're going, oh, look at them northern lads in the park. And I was thinking, oh, look at you, southern lads in your polo necks.
Do you not remember that, Steve? Do you not remember the night, no?
I remember the gig, but I don't remember the party.
No, you came to a party but didn't hang around long.
No.
I don't blame you because people were quite rude. There was some toffs there and they were a bit haughty.
Huh?
Yeah, anyway. Right.
I was going to say, you could change the face of contemporary culture with a, you know, if you'd, you know, blown up the house that night. Everybody was there, weren't they? Blimey.
Yeah. So, yes, you were. Everyone was there. And do you know what? I'm going to say a week later. It probably wasn't. It was probably a couple of months later. But I went to another party there, and that was in Charlie Higson's house. And he said, we've got, they're going to knock the house down. He lived in a flat above a television shop, and you had to go through the television shop to get into this flat, and he said, they're going to knock it all down next week, so we're having a destruction party, and like you were given axes and things, and you smashed the house up. And I do remember I was having a Tom Tit on the toilet. Someone put an axe through the door.
We'd have stayed if we'd have been at that party.
Yeah. The whole house got wrecked. They smashed it to pieces, and we kept there on the night. And then on the morning, there was a bloke who knocked on the door and he said, there's been a reprieve. We'd all smashed it to pieces. So I legged it. I went, right, well, that's my cue to clear off and go home.
How long were they out with it after that then?
I didn't hang around to find out what happened.
So did you go and see the Fall regularly then, from then on? Yeah. Or?
Yeah. There's so many times that I can't remember. And I literally can't remember. You know, in those early days, Grotesque, when was that? 1981?
I think it was 80. Was it 80? I was around then anyway.
Around then, yeah. there was a lot of gigging then, and I think that was my, you know, the fall at the peak for me.
That was my doing the right things here, Paul.
They went right downhill, didn't they? Around about 85, I always think.
I always think of the fall in various, you know, almost like different groups.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, there's that period and then there's that period. And I really like the pre-80 period and the 80 to like 80, I'd say 82 period was one. There's like different groups.
Yeah.
Am I right in saying if other people said that?
Yeah. There's a massive change in sound, isn't it? I think.
Yes. Yeah. And,
I always say when they bought a guitar tuner, there was a big change in sound.
To tune the guitar.
They could tune, yeah, definitely. That Dragnet is completely out of tune, which is part of its charm. I
like things like that, though. I like things, you know, you can hear people singing in tune and playing in tune all day long, you know. But yeah. I'm looking for a bit of abstract impressionism.
Yes, well, indeed, that's the other thing about Mark. He didn't like playing in time either, in tune or in time.
Well, I like that. That's a great thing to do.
Yeah.
It's a bonus for me if you can get something that doesn't sound like anything else.
Yeah. So you got to know Mark quite well, I think, didn't you? Later, was that later on? Or?
Well, we bumped into each other, you know, here and there over years. Because I think, Paul, I asked you to do... Dizzy.
That wasn't me. I was going to get onto this story. This was after my time. This was Steve and Craig you asked, and they turned you down, didn't they?
Steve. Well, I didn't. No, Steve. It was Steve. I think it may have been. It was probably Mark first, and then Steve. I said, "Would you play the music for?" Because I'm going to do. I'd done Born Free, and that had been up in the top of the charts.
Yeah,
it was at number three, and then.
Whoa.
I said, I'm doing Dizzy. Do you want to do the music? And there was he got turned down.
Well, Steve, over to you at this point. Why did you turn it down then?
I spoke to Craig about it and Craig wouldn't do it.
Not interested.
Maybe with the words, the quote was, I don't like doing cover versions.
Oh, I.
Yeah. From someone in a band who did Victoria, Ghost in My House, and what's the music?
It's what my grandfather would say. You've been obstreperous.
Yes.
He's an awkward bugger, Craig, when he wanted to be.
It's funny because Mark was dead against us working with other people, but he was quite up for that.
Was he?
Yeah, he was. He would have, you know, he wouldn't have minded.
Because I think I said to Mark, why don't you do it with me? You know, we'll do it as a duo. But it got turned. Where was that? Now that might have been it. So that was in 1991, and I think it was at maybe Reading Festival or something.
Was it Phoenix Festival or Reading? Yeah,
all of them. I don't go to festivals anymore, but. In those days, first festival I went to, do you know what? The first festival I really went to was Reading in 1976. And on the afternoon, there was AC/DC, and it was their first appearance in Britain.
Wow.
On a Saturday afternoon.
Bon Scott.
Yeah. And I was going, look at that little kid with his haversack. That's what people came to say. They were going, hey, look, there's a little kid playing.
I always feel a bit sorry for him. He's still got to get them bleeding velvet shorts on every time they do a gig, hasn't he? What is he now? He's about 70 now.
I think he's got to be, yeah.
That's so, probably worse. Could be worse. Could be Kiss, I suppose.
Does he still have his haversack on?
I didn't know he ever wore a haversack. You're not getting him mixed up with Jimmy Clitheroe, are you?
He used to come on with a little haversack on.
Look at his lotion.
A little bike.
I'm sure you're getting two acts mixed up here.
No, he did. He didn't come on a bike, but he did have a sack on. I don't know if he still does.
Well, what was in that? Young,
yeah, he'd come on a little bike, take his sandwiches out.
Tell you what, they
lost highway to the hell.
They lost a lot when they went mainstream. AC/DC. That was a proper act. That was.
Yeah. Anyway, the fall. So there's my major link with the fall. We could have been at number one.
Could have been. I know. You could have got on top of the pop, Steve.
Oh no.
And you could forgive the Inspiral Carpets after all these years.
Yeah.
I'm not bitter. No, I've never got over that.
The best thing the actually it's a bonus is that I knocked off Robin Hood off Top of the Pops.
Did he?
Yeah.
Ryan Adams.
Yeah. He was number one for like 14 weeks. And then.
I know. Never won it. He was number. So you knocked him off. Fantastic.
Yeah, well, actually, it was you too, but they released The Fly, which lasted for one day. You had to buy it. And they did it to make him leave the top of the.
Right.
But it was actually me who did it, really.
Of course, definitely. That's a good claim to fame, that, isn't it? Knocking, that's Robin up there with Joe Dolce, that. Keeping Vienna off number one.
Yeah, shut up your face. How long was that number one? Shut up your face.
I don't know. It was more than 1 week, though, wasn't it? I think. How long were you number one then with Dizzy? Just to rub Steve's nose in it a bit more.
Come on.
Two weeks, number one.
And it was a good fun being on Top of the Pops. Did the fall do Top of the Pops?
No.
Oh, he'll be back in therapy next week, Jim.
Never, no. We got close to it a couple of times, but it never happened.
Yeah.
What you needed there was the right hit, Steve.
Well, that's right.
Well, Victoria must have been and Ghost in My House.
Well, that was the one, I think, was Ghost in My House. We got to number 30. And they said, if it goes up this next week, and go on Top of the Pops.
That would have been a treat to say, how would Mark have dealt with Top of the Pops?
Well, he did. He did it with In Spiral Carpets.
Did he?
Yeah, he guessed it on their single, I Want You. But
so he was on Top of the Pops?
He was, yeah. I was waiting in the car park with the engine running. Driving home with a bottle of wine.
You were saying, though, if you had done it, you might have ended up with Mark playing violin instead of the guy from the Wonder Stuff. I don't think number one would have been looming if Mark had got his violin out.
No.
There'd be another papal visit.
Violet, and he used to go around with that keyboard. When did that keyboard turn up?
Which one? The Snoopy?
I don't know. There's some keyboard that was always there on the side of the stage, and
and he'd give it a bit of a tinkle. Yeah,
he'd like touch it now and then, and go ding ding ding.
Absolutely, I've got no ear for getting the right key in it. Well, I think it was deliberate. I think it was. I mean, just by the laws of chance, you couldn't get the wrong key that often without doing it deliberately. It's a bit like Les Dawson, I suppose, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But that was when Mark Riley. We still set the keyboard up. So for like 6 months, it was just sat there, nobody playing it. So that was when Mark Smith used to go over and get. You get some god awful noises out of that. It's better than him fiddling with your amp, though, Steve, wasn't it? I suppose. Kept him distracted.
Yeah. Well, he used to go and turn you down, didn't he? Or up.
Or up, or anything, yeah.
That's a weird thing to do. That's a great and a weird thing to do, isn't it?
I hated that.
But
it is. Live mixing, wasn't it, Steve?
Live mixing. No, I don't think.
Is that true that you used to put a dummy mic in the bass drum so that you could move it without affecting the sound?
Yeah, because he'd pull the. Yeah, we'd have one hidden under them, like a pillow, so he'd pull the microphone out, but it wouldn't make any difference.
What was he trying to achieve?
I've got a theory, but I don't know whether to say it.
Well, you have to. This is what the whole.
You got to now. You can't leave it there like that.
Look at me. I'm the boss, I think. I don't think there's anything else but that. I could have guessed. My stage, and I can do what I want.
I suppose, yeah. That was his. He was you'd have to get Mark on a good day. I got him on good days. He was very, you know, when he's in, he's like really most polite, and it'd be really, really nice and polite. And then you knew that as soon as your back was turned.
But one thing we've talked about with the books and everything, and Steve's book and Simon's and Brix's, it's more interesting. The problem is, you're going to tell the story of when it kicks off because it's more interesting. So I think people get a bit of an unbalanced view. I mean, they were just like that all the time, and that's not the case, is it? It wasn't. You wouldn't have stuck it for however many years you did it.
No,
you
wouldn't have done all them tours and all them records.
Yeah. The last time I saw Mark was I was out with Graham Duff. Do you know him?
Yes.
Yeah.
We had him on here.
And he wrote a film script, I think, with which I'm looking at.
That's right, he did.
I was out with Mark and Graham, and we met in Piccadilly and went off to some places, some boozes that Mark took us to. And he said, I don't know, it was a pub. And he said, he took me to the upstairs room and said, this is where I always wanted to put the fall to play. And it was just the upstairs of a room in a pub. And I thought, why?
I wonder what pub that was then.
I don't know, but it was in the middle of
the King's Arms.
It was in the middle of Manchester. It might have been. It was in the middle of Manchester.
It wouldn't have been a King's Arms because that was a proper venue, wouldn't it? The King's Arms upstairs. Yeah. It wouldn't have been that.
It was an upstairs room in a pub, and it wasn't very big. But he liked the boozer and said, this is why I always wanted the fall to play. But it was hardly any size at all. Really small. And then we sat outside. I just got a new camera, a Fuji camera, and I said, "Can I take some pictures? I'll take some pictures of you lads." Yeah, and I gave. And it was raining, and we sat outside in the beer garden having a fag. And I said, "Here, hold this umbrella." And I took some really good pictures of Mark with this umbrella, but really fuzzy and out of shape, and like. Not very good at all, but I thought it kind of suits him in some way. But he was really posing.
Right.
Like saying, oh, no, I don't want to do it. I'm not bothered. And that, but he was really posing hard.
And that's the Falls career in a nutshell, that. There you go.
Yeah.
So have you done anything with him? Have you still got him, or have you put him anywhere?
Gone, yeah. I should do something with them. I think. Well, I did give a couple to Graham, and he put them in his book,
yes, that's right. Yeah. I'd be interested to see if he could ever make that into a series because it's pretty good, isn't it? I don't know if you've read it, the script.
What the film?
Well, I think it was a TV series. I think it was eventually how they ended up. I think.
I don't know. It's.
It's quite strange.
It'll never, you know, it's never going to go on commercial television, is it?
No, I don't think they're keeping Saturday Night free for it. But get it on Netflix.
Now there's so many opportunities. It's so open now. Yeah, it's great that things like that might actually happen.
You've got a film, haven't you? Have you started it yet?
No, we started it in March. We wrote it 10 years ago. And at the moment, it's looking like, well, it's going to happen. We're going to do it in March and we're filming it. But when we wrote it, I think we still thought we were a bit younger than we were when we wrote it. And now we're a lot older. It's just like a pensioner's road trip love story.
You weren't in the first flushes of youth if you'll excuse me 10 years ago.
Well, I'm 62 now. When we wrote it, we were 52, but I think we kind of thought we were about 40.
Right,
wrote it, you know, with us in mind, because you don't really age when you become a pop star or a film star. So you kind of stick with that age.
Yeah.
And, apart, unless you're Mark Smith. You just age.
Where's the road trip?
What?
Where's the road trip?
Well, the road trip goes from Stockton to the Lake District, and it is the story. Oh, it's like the Holy Grail, but for modern times. So the Holy Grail now is a bit of showbiz memorabilia, and it's Michael Jackson's glove.
Oh, right.
So that it's the hunt for his glove, his training glove, actually. It's not even his real glove, it's his training glove.
What's he
training to be, you know, with his, you know, for his glistening, you know, his glistening glove?
Yeah.
Yes. It's just a gardening glove. Really.
So it's definitely his then, or is it all in the Reds?
No, it's actually his training glove, and we have to go and get it.
What's he training how to wear a glove?
Training to, you know, gives him his powers of, I don't know, why did he wear one glove?
I don't know.
No one knows, but that's apparently in the, you know, it gives him his power to do to do his moonwalk.
It's a documentary then, is it?
No, it's a proper action film. There's love, terror, horror, the whole lot. It's all in there.
Brilliant. So, forgive my ignorance, how long does it take to make a film? If it's not a silly question.
Well, to make anything, any drama, usually you'd say 1 week for half an hour.
Right.
So this is, and it's a film, and it's 1.5 hours long, because I don't agree with any film being longer than 90 minutes.
Right. Well, we talked about this, but in the pictures, I can see it. Because we went to the last film I went to see at the pictures was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and you could easily lose an hour from that without even breaking a sweat.
So if you go to the pictures, you get in there, you sit down, you've got your hot dog, you eat that, and then the film starts.
Yeah,
and then if it's beyond an hour and a half, my arse can't take it.
Yes. Now, like I say, that Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I mean, that was a two trip to the toilet. That, I mean, you couldn't sit there for the whole of it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like, I'm not a big fan of James Bond films, but I couldn't do whatever it is, 3 hours. I'll never see that latest James
Bond. No, me not. Me neither. But whatever film you could say, but I think James Bond, you can't put up with that nonsense for more than an hour and a half, can you? I don't think.
Well, it's a, you know, James Bond jumping up and down, and, you know, it doesn't do it for me. I went into Coronation Street because I like that sort of thing. I like, Kitchen
Sink.
Yeah. My favourite film is Saturday Night and Sunday Morning.
Oh, what a film. That real Bert Finn stuff, that.
That's, you know, that's a film for me.
Yeah. But
a lad jumping around on roofs. I'm not interested.
So you weren't, as it turned out, when you were on current, you weren't Norris's secret love child in the end, were you? I don't think.
No, I wasn't. But when I got asked to do it, they said, I said, would you come into Coronation Street? And I said, if I was Norris's son, I'll do it. And then they took me by my word. And I'm not his son, but they made it as near as I could.
would you go back? They didn't kill you off, did they?
No, they didn't. I went off to Stoke-on-Trent to run some more news agencies. So they nearly allowed me to be Norris's son, which I thought I was, and he thought I was, but turns out I wasn't. But so you never know. I might come back.
You never know. So what's that like then? What's that like filming Coronation Street? That must be pretty full on, is it?
It's fantastic. It's you're in that. It's like being on Top of the Pops, and you go, wow, I'm actually on Top of the Pops. When I was 12, I was dreaming of this moment.
Yeah.
And when you stood ordering a drink in front of cameras at the Rover's Return, you get the same kind of, in fact, more of a feeling, I think, because I'm doing this.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. It's a bit clinical, isn't it, the old Top of the Pops thing, I think. People are always surprised about how small it was and how sort of shabby an operation it was.
It is. Well, it's... And like with Coronation Street, it's like you get in there, it's they've got like four scenes going on at the same time. And you get in there and they go, right, you go over there, do your scene and get out. And next thing, you know your lines, get in there, do it and clear off.
Yeah.
And it's like school. You're in the green room and you look on the there's like a notice board and it says your scenes are on Tuesday at 5:30. So you write it down, pick up your lines, you go away and you come back and do it.
Right.
It is
not like, a lot of rehearsal then.
It's a great way of operating, but like the producer said to me when he said, it's like it's a fast moving train, you've got to be right on it. All your lines, you turn up, no one's going to tell you, no one's going to, you know, give you back a rub and say, yeah, love. If you're not there, you're in trouble.
Right.
And sometimes you do a scene which is maybe at 8 o'clock in the morning and it's for, you know, it's a 10-second scene. So it'll take you, I don't know, 10 minutes to do. So you turn up at 10 o'clock in the morning and then you're out the back door at 8:30 and you think, oh, well, hang on, I'll go and have a look around the war museum. it's what a great thing to do.
Yeah, it sounds.
So how long were you in it?
3 months.
Right. So did you live in Manchester then for the 3 months or did you
what happened, commute? You know, here and there. I've been living in Kent since 1995. So, I'll go up and get the train up the night before, go and stay in the Holiday Inn, get up and do a scene that lasts 5 seconds. And then think, oh, I'll go and have a look around Manchester for the rest of the day. And it's really lovely. What a great job.
Yes.
You know.
Definitely. Didn't you? You've got the piano, haven't you, out of Granada? Is that right?
I did, actually, yeah. I got. I didn't know you. How do you know about that?
Hey, one does one's research, you know.
Yeah, I got the piano in my. And it's the piano in my house, which was at the. I tell you where it was. It was from the ITV rehearsal rooms in London.
Right.
And it was the piano that was there from I think 1970 till 1993 or something, and so everyone's been on it, you know, Les Dawson, everyone, and all over it are like whiskey marks where you like people have put drinks down and it's scorched the
blimey
veneer. Fag marks where fags have burnt down.
Different times.
Yeah, and now you think, oh, there's Les Dawson's fag that's burnt down.
No mystery there.
Yeah.
It's played for, you know, Morecambe and Wise, Les Dawson, Desmond, everyone.
It must be worth a fortune, that piano.
How did you get that?
Absolutely nothing. But it's the history, isn't it? Things like that. I got it from... it was a woman called Christine Kent, who was a makeup woman who worked for years. Well, she still is working there. And she said, I've got this piano and I don't want it. I'm moving. So do you want it? And she gave me that. So I just got it delivered to my house.
Very good. Yeah. In tune.
It's really good, actually. It's a real crappy looking piano, but it didn't have to play well.
Barmy. I've heard you playing. I saw a film you're doing. You're quite the piano player, aren't you?
Not. I don't know. I muck about on things. I started off playing bass.
Oh, you'll get nowhere playing the bass.
Thankless job, that.
Do you know what I don't about you, Paul? But Steve. But I got a guitar and I realised that I was. I was playing the bass. I was playing along with the top notes, along with records, just because I like the sound of it. I like the deep sound.
Why did you pick the bass then, Steve?
You what?
I'm just wondering, what was your motivation, Steve, for picking the bass instead of a guitar or drums? Or
couldn't afford a drum kit.
Here's where we go wrong. This is where we diff. The first thing I got was a drum kit. And I could only play it in the garage on a Saturday when my mum and dad were out. They wouldn't let it in the house. It wouldn't, for one thing, it wouldn't fit. The other thing, it was too loud. So I could only do it in the garage on a Saturday when they were out shopping. And I could learn how to do drum rolls on my bed. I'm very good at drum rolls and nothing else. This is a waste of time. I swapped it with a bloke. You know, Exchange and Mart, I suppose it was, one of those things. And some other kid, I said, I want to swap a drum kit for a guitar. So I went, my dad took my drum kit round to this kid's house. Wally, he was called.
And, the guy at the Sex Pistols, was it?
Amazing
you remember his name.
Well, we became really good friends. I suppose we were about 14. And anyway, so I said, I'm swapping this drum kit for your guitar. And he had loads of guitars. And he was a genius at playing anyone. Can you play like Hendrix? You've gone, yeah, like, oh, that's good. How about Paul Kossoff? Yeah, I can do him as well. And he'd play like Kossoff. And they go, what about Eric Clapton? Anyone, he'd play like him. But he was, he never really got anywhere. He was in a band called Dan for a while. Don't know if you remember them.
What were they called? Dan?
Dan, D-A-N.
No.
Anyway, he was brilliant. He's a genius.
Is it not a bit of a hindrance that, because that's the thing that we've talked about with the Fall before, is the way they played is because it's the only way anybody knew how to play. Do you know what I mean? Once you can play like anybody, how do you know who to play like, if that makes sense?
Yeah, well, you know, you've got to find your own shape.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think he was a genius in the way that he could mimic anyone. That's quite a skill, I think.
Yeah, yeah. He could have got a job in the band for Stars in Your Eyes, couldn't he?
Yeah.
He'd have been good on that.
Yeah. Well, I swapped the guitar, and then I've got this acoustic guitar off him, swapped for a drum kit for an acoustic.
He saw you coming, didn't he? Acoustic guitar for a drum kit.
Depends on the acoustic guitar.
Well, you know what? You just go for size, though. I think it was a brilliant drum kit. it was a cheap, shitty kid's drum kit that I swapped for a very exciting Martin acoustic guitar.
Yeah, all right, okay, I'll take it back.
I don't think it was Martin, I don't know what it was. But, so I ended up just sort of like, you know, playing along to records. Like it was a bass, and I thought, I might as well just start playing.
Might as well play the bass.
My first gig was, I was playing bass with Wally, who had my drum kit, and another lad called Robin, who had a guitar, and I think we kind of started playing. It sounded like Hawkwind. It was just like,
Fill the machine.
And it went on for about 25 minutes.
Yeah.
And it was just in Robin's front room when we were about 14 or 15. And then I looked outside of his front window, and there was a load of girls in Bay City Rollers costume, you know, doing that Bay City Rollers dance. And they're going, we're pop stars already. We have
You're never going to top that, are you? That's peak career, that then.
That's it. That's when you know that you've got something going.
So did you play in any bands?
Yeah, and the first band I was in, I was like 15 or 16, and we used to play in this pub called the Bowes Wine Cellar in Darlington, and it was so slender. It was a really thin, long bar. And I was playing bass, and I had to lift the neck of my bass up to let people.
Yes, I've done that.
Yeah. You know, that where you kind of I thought it's quite a good look, this, isn't it? So a bit like Andy Fraser from Free, you lift your arm up and down all the way, you know, throughout your performance.
So is that like the Bill Wyman kind of playing it sort of almost upright kind of thing?
Well, yeah, but if you can imagine Bill Wyman and Steve's bass playing in, and you do a, you know, sort of flicker between the two of them.
To let people pass that London Bridge.
Up and down, yeah.
So you know that so you never know, that was the highlight of your career, was it?
That's yeah.
Apart from having two number ones, and you know,
You know, I remember those days very fondly. Of you know, really getting excited and going out and doing a gig on a Friday night at a pub.
Yeah.
Just
because I was in a covers band for a while. I used to really like that sort of people. The only people were there just by accident, you know.
You know,
so you get them listening.
Talking of covers band, I was the Human League. There was Russell who was in the Human League. Do you know him?
When was he in the Human League?
In the early 90s.
Oh right, okay, yeah.
Russell was anyway. So I did a record with the Human League. And Russell was playing guitar. He was in the Weekenders as well. Electric Russell, he was in the Weekenders.
Oh, right, okay.
And so he said, I'm going off to, I'm leaving the Human League and I'm going to Spain to join my brother in a covers, he's got a covers band in Spain. And so he went off and did that. And then years later, I met my wife and we were looking through some old photographs. And I said, look, that's Russell, who was in the Human League. And she said, oh, yeah, we went to Spain and he was in a covers band.
Wow.
And his brother copped off with my sister.
Well, they're small.
Two days earlier, he was telling me that he was going there, and then you've got the evidence of him 2 days later being there.
Wow. Speaking of coincidence, the Weekenders, is that the one? Didn't you film some of that in Withenshaw?
Yeah, we did, yeah.
Well, that's just near our pie shop. That was just down the road.
Right. Is there a big ship farm nearby?
A ship farm?
The sewage works.
I don't think so. Well, you were at that pub you were outside in New All Green, which is like five minutes walk.
Oh, yeah, that was. And that pub, we renamed it. We named it after a Yes song. A song from Topographic Oceans. Because we thought, we thought it was funny at the time, like, you know, pubs being, because I think I'd seen a pub named after some prog record. why would you? Someone's a fan in there, and it was, you know.
Yeah.
So we called it we changed the pub to the name of a Yes song.
All right. Because Phil Oakey was the barman, wasn't he?
He was at a meat festival. Russell, who I was just talking about, was in that pub. Did we film the pub? Yes.
Well, if you'd have wandered down the road there, you could have come and bought a pie in our shop.
If I'd have known, I would have done. I love pies.
All right. Not to see us, just for the pie.
No, but to see you. Well, if I'd have known that, if you would have known that. But what's your favourite pie?
I think I'd have to go for a meat and potato. If we're talking Hollands, are you talking like make your own pies and posh pies in restaurants, or are you talking about pies in pie shops?
Well, I don't know. How proper was your pie shop?
Proper at all. We used to sell Hollands pies. We used to make our own Cornish pasties.
But did you have a lot of meat and veg in there?
We did have meat. Yeah, we had a meat car.
Did you put plenty in, or did you skimp on it?
Oh, the sandwiches. You mean in the pies?
Yeah.
Well, we only made Cornish pasties, and we didn't put a lot of them out. I used to go to this place. Probably what the smell you could smell was this place called the Meat Market, and they used to sell this really sort of rammy meat, and he used to buy that and put it in the pasties. I'm surprised we didn't kill anybody, to be honest.
So I like a steak and kidney pie for me, with more kidney than steak.
See, you don't get it anymore, do you? You don't get kidney in pies anymore.
I love kidney. I'm an awful freak.
Funnily enough, I was watching an interview with you where you said you were in a restaurant in France and you bought a shit sausage.
I did, yeah.
That was a andouille, is it?
Yeah, and it was. And my wife said, Nancy says, I can smell shit round here. I said, it's sausage here.
And well, I went to France with work once, and they took me. They obviously set me up. They took me to this restaurant, and they said you should have the local delicacy, this andouille, and it is the worst smelling thing. I couldn't eat it. Couldn't get near it. It was disgusting.
It's pigs' intestines, isn't it? It's
stink. And but it smells of shit.
It is exactly, and you are eating the shit that's like glued to the sides of the its tubes. But when I eventually end up on death row, the final dinner will be
meal.
What's your final dinner? What would you like? I'll say probably liver and onions and mash.
Oh, I don't like liver and onions.
No.
Ox liver or lamb's liver?
I'll go for a calf's liver.
Oh, it's very, very bitter.
I like it. I love it.
No, I can't be doing my liver and onions.
I might use that, and I'll say, can I have, you know, I don't want a pudding, but I'll have a steak and kidney pie instead.
Oh, you could have a steak and kidney pudding?
Yeah, well, I'll have a steak and kidney pudding. I've got one in the fridge, actually.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Fall podcast, everybody, where we dissect the fall within an inch of
its life. It's awful.
We should talk about the fall. We're running out of time, so we should probably try and squeeze them back into the conversation, shouldn't we?
Yeah.
So when was the last time you saw them live, the fall, Jim?
I stopped going to see bands. Groups some years ago. I think it might have been, I can't remember, but I did remember walking around, I think it was the Phoenix Festival, and I bumped into Mark, and he was having a kip around the back of a caravan thing. He was laid on a pallet having a sleep. And I said, hello. And he woke up and he immediately went into his polite mode. Hello, come in here. Why didn't you?
Welcome to my pallet.
Yeah, he got off his pallet. He got off and came in and said, I have a cup of tea and some speed. So we had a nice little chat there. I said, Bob Dylan's on stage. I've never seen him. Are you interested? And he said, no. I said, no, neither am I.
But I think there's a kind of similar thing with the Fall and the Bob Dylan, in that you never know what you're going to get on the day, do you? Sometimes he'd be like amazing, and sometimes he's kind of.
I know people are big fans of Bob Dylan, but he's never really done it for me. I've not paid that much attention, to be honest.
You do a good impression of him.
How many people say sound like it? They've copied him. When you hear him, think, "Ooh,
yeah.
Ooh, why would you want to copy someone like that?"
Did Bob Dylan just walk in?
I keep hearing people on Six Music now, and I think, "Oh, you've been listening to The Fall, haven't you?" And you do get people. Can't think of any names just now, but I keep thinking, but you're never going to be able to do it, really.
No, they never sound like The Fall, do they? It's like the people, Pavement going about how they sound like The Fall, but they don't really sound anything like The Fall to me.
No one's ever going to sound like The Fall because it's so unique. I know, that's what I love about The Fall is, I'm always on the lookout for something that doesn't sound like something else, and it doesn't happen very often.
No, I think that was the genius of Mark, really. Even to the, if he was adamant that they wouldn't sound like anybody else, even if they made them slightly worse sometimes, it was more important to be different than competent, if you know what I mean, sometimes.
Well,
the Room to Live is the one we all talk about, because we always had a bit of a crap time making it, but I think it was quite important in the end that he took The Fall away from how they sounded before,
I really like Room to Live.
Do you?
Yeah.
People do.
I'm always surprised.
I think it's got some. I really, really like it, and it came out. It was like a 10-incher, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, no, Slates was the 10-inch, wasn't it?
Was it Slates?
Yeah.
Well, I like Slates as well. I like that. I like Grotesque Slates and Room to Live, that the period I really like.
Well, we've never been able to listen to Room to Live with an unjaundiced ear, really, because we had such a horrible time making it.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't the Burma Railroad or, you know, salt mines, but it was just a bit crap, you know.
Was it, so has your memory been tarnished by the...
Well, yeah, it always is.
Definitely.
It always is. Whatever album puts you back into the mood at the time.
So you always say that about all of them, though, don't you, Steve? That,
yeah.
Does it take you back to the horror of those days? Maybe you should have a listen to it again. You know, do a bit of self-therapy and that.
No, I always think it would have been a good album 6 months later.
Do you think, what was it, the production that you didn't like?
No, it was just under...
We didn't know them. We didn't know the songs.
Under-rehearsed and under... Yeah.
Well, sometimes that's not a bad thing. You know, it's like you were saying that when things are, you know, you start doing things on purposely out of tune and it's going to sound wrong. If it sounds amateur, that's right. That's a good thing.
That's the thing about the Fall that they managed that, and it is that, you know, they managed to do that, or Mark managed to do that for so long. It's quite, because bands don't get that sort of level of, it must have took a lot of will to still be able to do that after like 40 years. Incredible, really.
It's quite a fine line. You have to, otherwise people just wouldn't like it and say, I'm not having this.
Yeah.
Like when it is a fine line. It's especially fine when it comes to the Fall, because if you listen to someone like Karlheinz Stockhausen, you go, I see where he's going to, and it's a bit forced.
Yeah.
With the Fall, it fell in that camp that was so beautifully between naivety and forced professionality. I don't know. You know what I mean? It's like...
There was a lot of naivety.
If I can refer to it in terms of painting, you can have something that's forced naivety, and you can have stuff that is really naive, and there's somewhere in the middle where it's like right on the border.
Yeah,
you know, like just like, and that's where you get true beauty.
Yeah. So it must be very difficult. How do you avoid, do you not just, you don't get better to the point where you can't do naive after a while because you've been doing it so long? It must be difficult to sustain as well, mustn't it?
What, painting?
Yeah.
Well, I drift betwixt the two. I go naive and I go the right opposite.
Yeah. Sophisticated.
Yeah, that's the word. Highly sophisticated.
Yeah. So we should talk about, if talking about your paintings, we should talk about Carrier Bag Man, shouldn't we?
Yeah.
Oh, that painting. Yeah, yes, well, I did Carrier Bag Man. I did, first of all, when I did that painting, it was, I'd just done a kind of, I did various photocopies. I photoshopped a Greek Roman statue and then changed the shape of his legs and really battered it out of shape and did a really nice out of shape Roman statue. And I thought, I'm not happy with it. And I was listening to Carry Bag Man and I thought, I'm just going to put a carrier bag in his hand. And then I messed about with it more and more over about 6 months and then wrote all the lyrics all over it.
Wow.
And I really like it.
Yeah, it's great.
That's in the gallery.
There's a great picture of you, Mark, and Steve in front of it.
I really like that painting. It's one of the few paintings that actually means something to me. So I might actually, if it doesn't sell, I'll have it back and I'm going to...
It doesn't mean enough to you to not sell it.
Well, I'm saying that, it might have already sold, I don't know.
Yeah, all right.
But if it hasn't sold, I mean, I can't do anything about it then.
No.
Right, now give us the money back.
Well, I tell you what, I was going to say, I've seen an interview where you described, if you had to describe Manchester as a bird, you'd go with a crow, is that right?
Yeah, it's got that, crows are really like intelligent, friendly birds, but they're black and mysterious.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I have a bit of a problem with that, because when I was on the chase, the question that knocked me out was, what kind of creature is a corvid?
Yeah.
And that's a crow, isn't it?
Yes.
I've held them in high dudgeon ever since.
What did you say?
I said I thought it was an insect, a corvid. As everybody knows, apparently everybody in the world knows that a corvid's a type of bird.
And now you do, no.
I do know, I'm not forgetting that.
No, we'll stick with that. I like corvids.
I do.
I like crows. I really like them.
Is a magpie a corvid?
Yes.
Right, I like a magpie.
You name all the corvids, the British corvids.
Okay. Magpie, blackbird.
No.
Blackbird's not a corvid. Okay.
No. You got a crow, rook, hooded crow, jay, chough.
Chough,
yeah. It's got a red beak and red legs, and you find them in Cornwall.
Okay, right. Yeah. So you're particularly drawn to painting birds, aren't you?
Yeah.
I do like painting birds, yeah, because I just like it, you know. I've got to a stage in my life where I kind of just do what I like, you know. I've always been like that. I'm relaxing more. I don't like going out and doing telly shows, and I don't really like going out of my house much, really. So the thing I do, which is what I like, is stay at home and paint birds.
Right.
You know.
Have you seen Edwin Collins? He's a great artist at birds as well.
Yeah, yes, he's very good.
Not as good at corvids as you, but, you know, you can't have everything, can you?
Oh, I don't just do corvids. That's the title of the next album.
After Jim does Lent, then it's I don't just do corvids.
Anyway, lads, I'm going to have to go because I'm...
Yeah, yes.
No.
Thumbs up. Thanks so much for that, Jim. That was great. Yes, I really enjoyed that. Great to speak to you.
Before we go, can I do an advert for your pies?
Go on, then.
Well, give us the lines and I'll do it.
Hamlish pies, unavailable since 1992.
Right, are you ready? Hamlish pies, available since 1992. You won't get a better steak and kidney pie than a Hanley steak and kidney pie.
Yeah, you would have been millionaires. Would have been millionaires with that. I'll let you go.
All right, thanks.
All right,
thanks
very much.
See you.
See you, mate.
All right.
Thanks for joining us this week on Old Brother. Please follow us on Twitter at Old Brother Show, where you can subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher or RSS, so you'll never have to miss an episode. While you're at it, give us a rating on iTunes. Or if that's too much like hard work, at least tell your mates about us. You might also want to check out our personal Twitter accounts, at HanleyPA and at StephenHanley6 with a PH. Our books, The Big Midweek and Leave the Capital, are also available from Root Publishers or all good bookstores. Hope to see you all again soon, and remember, if you're driving, take your car. Ta-da.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.